I received a blinker message, MSG, Lieutenant J.G. Himmel by the time. I'm on the transport behind you. We'll see you in ADAC. That's where we were headed, to ADAC, which is another base. Dad, my father was a country doctor who had volunteered to go back in. He'd been in World War I as a army captain doctor, and he volunteered at the age of 47 or 48 to go back in for World War II, and was jumped up to colonel and put in command of a combat field hospital. And his combat field hospital was headed for the invasion of Pisgah. And so just before we got to ADAC, there was a report of a submarine sighted 100 miles or so away, and our ship was ordered to go look for it. So the skipper very graciously had us peel off to go right close aboard the transport. I had sent a message over that we were being detached and I wouldn't be able to see my dad in ADAC. He was on the deck and we waved at each other about 50 feet apart as the ships were passing. And I figured that might be the last time I'd see him, because I'd seen how rugged the Japanese were in the battle for Attu, none of them surrendering. So I did not get to see him in ADAC, and the next time I joined up with him, we were headed, escorting them, headed for Kiskeh. As it turned out, his combat field hospital was to go ashore in the third wave, and our destroyer was to lead his wave in, providing gunfire support. So again, I had a chance to wave at him in a distance as they were taken off, and really was worried about what was going to happen to him. And it turned out that Kiskeh was the one place in the whole war that the Japanese had abandoned instead of fighting for. They had left in a very dense fog a few days before we landed, so there was no battle there, which was a great relief to me. About 2 weeks later, I managed to shore and find my dad, who was living in a pup tent in this half-frozen tundra. Had shower for those 2 weeks, been living on K rations the way the Marines do. And I took him out to the ship in the boat, got him a warm shower and a change of clothes, and took him into the wardroom for a steak dinner and ice cream and strawberries for dessert. When he got through, he turned to the skipper and said, "I'd rather be an ensign in the Navy than a colonel in the Army in any war." And then we took him back ashore.
Was he actually serving with the Army?
Yeah, he was colonel in the Army. That was the Aleutian campaign. We left the Aleutians by the time Kiskeh was observed to be clear, and headed back for Hawaii. The Aleutian campaign was a very tough one, because it was almost constantly dense fog. We went for about 3 months without even seeing the ship nearest to us. You know, you had them all on the radar and you could keep in formation, but airplanes took off, and it was very tough for them. If the fog closed in, they had to make landings that were very dangerous. We frequently lost a plane in the fog. If someone fell over the side in rough weather, the water was so cold that if you hadn't retrieved them within about 10 minutes, they died from hypothermia. That happened in a couple of cases. So leaving that, as a result, a certain percentage of the crews developed claustrophobic reactions and would have mental problems. The officer who was scheduled to relieve me didn't relieve me at the end of a mid-watch, when he should have been up there at 4 o'clock, and We searched the ship and couldn't find him, and finally, after about 45 minutes, he was located cowering in the fire control director. Under the director, there was a kind of a little repair space, and he was in there like a wild animal, just sort of like this. We had to send a couple of bosun's mates in to drag him out and put him in a straitjacket and later transfer him to a ship and send him back to the States. And that happened with probably 5% of the crews while we were up there.
So because of the conditions in that place, the fog or the...
The combination of not being able to see anything almost every day, the knowledge that if you went into the water you were going to freeze to death in no time, it really affected some people quite seriously. So when we were headed almost due south to go to Hawaii, there was a great relief, and I'll never forget how suddenly one day we just broke out of this dense fog bank, 100 miles or so from Hawaii, and there was this gorgeous blue, warm water, and what a wonderful sensation that was. When we got back to Hawaii, I had orders waiting, transferring me from the Phelps to go to a ship that was being built, the destroyer Robinson, and flew back to the States, and then was promptly turned around to fly back to Hawaii to go to a 6-week school to learn how to be a fighter director, someone who controlled airplanes and vectored them out to intercept the enemy and that sort of thing, which was part of the duties that I would have on the Robinson as the battle evaluator and combat information officer. And the Robinson, we then went, after some shakedown training, back into the battles of the in South Pacific. It was on the Robinson that I did the regions of the Palau Islands, several New Guinea, did the invasion of Leyte to begin to recover the Philippines, and fought a major second battle of the Philippines. My destroyer was involved in the Battle of the Surigao Straits, which was the southern part of that. And we did a torpedo attack against the Japanese Southern Force, which included a battleship and a couple of cruisers, as I recall, and some destroyers, all of which were sunk, with I think one ship escaped. These details you need to check to make sure I'm not remembering inaccurately. We had fired half of our torpedoes in that action. We had with us the older battleships that had been badly beaten up at Pearl Harbor, and them were all repaired. And they had fired up all of their armor-piercing ammunition in sinking the southern Japanese forces. When we got the word that the Japanese had come through with their center forces through San Bernardino Straits and had caught the slow escort carriers and were beginning to start sinking them, as it turned out, I think they sank one or two and damaged some others. And there was a marvelous piece of action by the destroyers and destroyer escorts protecting them, who conducted a series of torpedo attacks which forced the Japanese to turn away each time and gave the escort carrier the chance to get a little further distance. But they would have all been sunk, and this powerful Japanese middle force would have come in to deal with us, and could not have been handled because the armor-piercing shells from our battleships had been expended. They had only bombardment ammunition left for gunfire support ashore, and we didn't have very many torpedoes left.
And the main carrier forces had been drawn up to the north.
And Halsey had taken our fast battleships to the north to get the carrier force instead of leaving the battleships at San Bernardino Straits, which he should have done. So for several hours, we were just sitting there waiting to be sunk, and then received the wonderful news that the Japanese had decided to go back north instead of coming south. If the Japanese admiral had not made that decision, I think that the Second Battle of the Philippines would have been another great disaster and would have lengthened the war another year, maybe. But our part of it was very exciting and very successful. And years later, when I was the Navy chief and flew to Japan to be a guest of the Japanese CNO, at a dinner party, he had, among others, the Admiral Ataya, who was then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs in Japan. And in the course of exchanging views with each other, we discovered that he had been on one of the ships that in that southern forest that had been sunk by our torpedoes and the Japanese and the battleship ammunition. So at that point, Admiral Ataya toasted me for my marksmanship, and I toasted him for his survivability. He'd swum ashore and escaped.
So that your experience at Leyte Gulf, I mean, how much time elapsed in this process? Was it all, did this all happen in a single day, or?
The invasion occurred, I think October 20th, don't hold me to that, and I think it was 3 days later that the Japanese had organized this triple play. Carrier forces coming down from Japan, the southern forces coming up and splitting into two groups, the southern group coming up through the straits, and the northern group coming through the San Bernardino Straits. I think it was about 3 days later that they hit us. I think it was October 23rd, but again, there's a very good description of that battle written by T.J. Cutler that will have the accurate details in it. Following that battle, we then did an invasion of Mindoro Island, fairly uneventful, and then participated in the landings at Lingayen Gulf, which liberated the island of Luzon and the city of Manila. And in that action, late one night after a day of gunfire support, Japanese small craft was suddenly sighted just a few hundred yards away, and when the ship went to general quarters, this thing speeded up. It had been getting paddled in, so it was you didn't hear an engine. But when they realized they were detected, they speeded up. Apparently, the only thing they had was some charges of some kind, which they threw over the side next to the ship, and it gave a big blast and rattled the ship. It didn't do any real damage. And then, following that action, we were sent back to the coral atoll of Ulithi, which there was a replenishment place, and were there at anchor when the announcement came that the Japanese emperor had called for surrender. I'll never forget the. We could see that on the other ships, I was off to the deck and I could see that the other ships had broken out beer in violation of the regulations, but it was such a great occasion that they were serving beer to the officers and men. So I called the skipper and reported this to him and requested permission to do the same on board our ship. And he said, it's a great idea. Let me talk to the Commodore, who was on board our ship. The Commodore was a very almost prissy type, who was very tall and very very dignified. We called him Sir Robert Camel because he looked so much like British nobility and had that same sort of haughty demeanor. And he said, absolutely not. And then he invited the skipper to get in the boat with him, and they went off. And in the boat, where it was legal, they began to drink beer. So at that point, I took it on myself to just make a decision, and I got the keys to the beer locker and went down and instructed the senior chief bosun's mate to get the leading petty officer from each of the divisions up, and I issued enough to each leading petty officer to provide 3 cans of beer for each man, and told them to get it drunk and get it, all signs of it off the ship as fast as possible. And it went almost perfectly, except that the exec with whom I roomed, I was the number 3 officer on board, came running in to me and said, Sammy, get up. They've broken into your beer locker. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I walked into the ship's office and the yeoman was sitting there drinking a beer. And I said, where'd you get that? And he said, well, they're passing it out in the forward hold. And so I got up and inspected the ship and came back and was able to report truthfully to the exec that I couldn't find the sign of a beer anywhere. And got back and lay down in the bunk. I was in the upper bunk, the exec was in the lower bunk, and we were taking our afternoon siesta. He was a very slow-moving, slow-thinking Texan, Tex Winslow, we called him. And after about 15 minutes, it suddenly dawned on him. He got up and he shook me and said, congratulations. He figured out what I had done.
He didn't ask where his 3 beers were?
No. I of course, didn't take any, so it would be clear that I was just doing it for the guys. And so years later, we had a ship's reunion, and he told the skipper about this, and the skipper was highly pleased that it had been done, because he'd always thought the Commodore had made a very namby-pamby decision. After that day, we were ordered to go up to escort and protect the minesweepers that were going to be sent to sweep the Yangtze River mines so that our ships could go into Shanghai. And after a day or two there, we captured first a Japanese LST, and then later a 1,200-ton Japanese river gunboat, the HIJMS Ataka. And that was the ship that I was put on to head prize crew skipper with 2 ensigns. I was a full lieutenant by that time, and 15 sailors. And we found the charts to the minefields and sent a message to the admiral and got permission to go up the river. And the story of that is in my book on watch. I led the meeting Muzin and all the rest.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to that, I'd like to ask you about that in a minute, but when the war ended, how long did it take you to hear about and comprehend the fact that the world had changed with the introduction of new weapons, the atomic bomb dropped on Japan? What was your opinion of all of that as the news of that filtered down to you?
To a man, we thought it was wonderful that President Truman had made the decision, because we already had the op orders on board for the invasion of Japan, and it was clear that the casualties, based on what had happened at Okinawa, where the Japanese and Iwo Jima, where the Japanese just dug in and fought the last man, and we took heavy casualties, that we were headed for 1 million casualties if we'd gone into Japan dead and wounded, and the Japanese probably 2 or 3 times that number. The time during the civilians that would be killed in preparation for the battlefield and so forth. So the fact that 200,000 or 300,000 Japanese were killed by that first weapon, and another of that same number by the second weapon, we all viewed as cheap in terms of total lives lost, and wonderful in that none of them were American lives. And it was only years later that it began to be sophisticated to think about whether or not that was a great crime to have done that. The other thing that has never really been properly brought into the debate is that we were firebombing Japanese and Italian cities and firebombing Japanese cities, and we were killing thousands and thousands of innocent civilians in both theaters with non-nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. so that the nuclear weapons that were dropped probably did not kill as many Japanese as the firebombing of Tokyo did.
Oh, sure. One night, 100,000. Yeah,
that's
right. I think the thing that bothered people on that was that it was one plane and one weapon instead
that's
of
right.
entire waves of them.
That's
that
right.
Done
yeah.
How long did it take you to understand, when you first heard about the atomic bomb, was there any sense of we understand what this is, or?
It was, of course, absolutely a surprise to everybody. Only the very most senior people in the country knew about it. But you immediately comprehended, you know, we'd had enough physics to comprehend the massiveness of it. And that immediately began to lead you into thinking about what the future was going to be like as both sides acquired nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. But for the moment, knowing that we were the sole possessors of it, it was a wonderful feeling that the war was going to end fast.
Mm-hmm. Having read your account already of your experience in Shanghai and meeting your future wife in that lengthy letter, is there anything you would like to add to your memories of that?
No, I think the letter you know, covers it in better detail and with closer memory than now.
Okay.
The letter ended, of course, at the point where the music for the wedding began. But I don't remember whether I have it in the book or not, but the it was to be a one-night honeymoon because my ship, the Robinson, was sailing the next morning. We were married on the 22nd, and the ship was to sail on the 23rd. And the wonderful thing that happened, the first and only time it ever happened to me in the Navy, and it only happened because the Navy didn't know I'd gotten married, my orders had come in that night transferring me from the number 3 position on the Robinson to wait in Shanghai for the destroyer Softly, which was coming in, and I was to become the executive officer on the Softly. So the exec, this fellow Tex Winslow, who was my roommate, who could have just let me come aboard and sail and then get back if and when I could to the Softly, had stayed up all night and packed my gear and had my orders written. And when I got to the gangway at 4 o'clock in the morning, he said, "Here's your sea bag, here's your orders, go back ashore and finish your honeymoon." And it was about a week before the Softly came in, and then the Softly operated in and out for a couple of weeks, so I had 3 weeks to be with Musa instead of just that one night.
Well, that must have been wonderful.
Yeah, it was a tremendous break.
Were you worried that I'm married, the Navy doesn't know it, I'm going to have to leave, and what's going to happen to her, and how am I going to accommodate getting her back to the States, or where she would be?
I was, and you know, one of the reasons that I was pressing her very hard to agree to marry was that I knew that if we didn't get married before I left, that it would be almost impossible for her to come to the United States in those days without a citizenship, and that even married at that time, it was going to take 2 years instead of 5 years for a wife to come in, 5 if you were unmarried, you'd have to apply and wait typically 5 years to come in. What I didn't know then, it hadn't happened, but on December 28th of that same year, Congress passed the GI Bride law, and we got back to the States in December, early December, I guess about December 12th, San Diego, where I was able to get off and travel to Tulare and have a reunion with my dad. Then went back to the ship and went, took her through the Panama Canal into New York Naval Shipyard for overhaul en route to Charleston to be decommissioned. While I was in New York.
For you to be decommissioned to the ship?
For the ship to be decommissioned. While we were in New York in the overhaul, this was now January, I had read in the newspaper about the passage of the GI Bill that permitted wives to come in as soon as they could get a visa, if they were married to a GI. So I took off and went to Washington in uniform. I knew nothing about Washington. I went to the State Department, which at that point was in the what is now the Executive Office Building on 18th and 17th in Pennsylvania. I walked up these huge steps and turned right, and the first sign I saw said, Assistant Secretary of State for Far Eastern Affairs. Well, that sounded about right, Far Eastern Affairs. So I went into his office, and I think, in retrospect, because I was in uniform, the secretary must have thought I was an officer messenger. I said, I'd like to see the assistant secretary. She said, go right in. He said, Lieutenant, what can I do for you? His name was E. Everett Drumright. And I said, I'm here to get my wife admitted to the United States from China. And he said, Lieutenant, you married a foreigner? And I said, yes, sir, my wife is French citizen living in Shanghai. He said, well, you know, it takes 2 years for something like that to be accomplished. I said, no, sir. I handed the newspaper article to him, and I said, that organization right over there, I pointed to Capitol Hill, has passed this bill on December 28th. I was really frustrated because I hadn't been able to get anyone in the whole system to acknowledge. So he read the article and he said, you know, we weren't aware of this. I'll have my attorneys confirm it, but if it's true that it passed and reads as it says here, well, I'll put a note in the pouch going out tonight to release your wife. So she got that, the consul got that message, and Musa was permitted to get on the first ship. It turned out to be an army ship with some army GI brides too. And came across arriving in March of 1946.
So how long was did she remain in Shanghai from the time that you left until she...
Well, we left in December. I said December 12th was the day we got back. I think that was the day we left for from Shanghai. And so it would have been 3 weeks later, near New Year's, when we got back to San Diego. I think the book will show those dates, but if not, we can get them. And so she was there from December until March, when she got on board this ship and arrived about March 20th or so.
So it was a remarkably brief time, considering what would have been the norm.
Yeah.
Normally.
That's right.
Okay. And your... What was your... Well, let me ask you this before we move to that. I understand that you had to use a little subterfuge to get your commanding officer to allow you to go ahead and be married.
Yeah, not really subterfuge. Well, it was in this sense that when I first went to see him, to tell him that I had been on board this gunboat up until just a very few days before it was time to get married. And I'd found out that you had to have the theater commander's permission to get married overseas. So I went to see the skipper and said, I met this girl, I'm in love and I'd like to get married. He said, Lieutenant, I'm not going to let you do that. He said, you're making a big mistake. He said, you know, I've been married 3 times, and do you know what my third wife did when I went to sea the last time? And I said, no, sir, expecting to hear some great scandal. He said, she took $500 out of the account and bought a fur coat without my permission. As though that were a horrible crime, you know. He said, this woman is foreign. That'll be very bad for your career. You'll never get ahead. And I'm just not going to let you do it. So I said, aye, aye, sir. And I arranged to have a dinner party, to which we invited him. And he met Musa and was, of course, immediately charmed by her. And called me in the next day and said, okay, permission granted.
Did he have that initial fear that just this automatic assumption that I guess commanding officers always have that if a young soldier or officer is going to marry a foreigner, that somehow this person is trying to take advantage of
that's right.
Becoming an American citizen? Or
I'm sure he had that feeling, and also he had bitter experiences in marriage, obviously. and it was probably reasonable advice for the time that a career officer marrying a foreigner probably did hurt his chances. As a matter of fact, when I went to my first tour of shore duty, the assistant professor for the NROTC at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, for the University of North Carolina, the skipper's wife was a Georgia woman who was so prejudiced against foreigners that she formed an organization that met weekly called Naval Officers College Graduate Wives Club. Musa had 2 years of college, but had not graduated from college. So she was the only wife of the officers who didn't qualify. She organized it that way to keep this foreigner out. And at that point, I then went to see a wonderful retired naval captain who had had the NROTC unit before he retired, a fellow who had grown up with General Eisenhower, his best friend, a fellow named Captain E.E. Hazlett, Sweet Hazlett, who would have become an admiral, but he had developed heart disease. And I said to him, I told him this story, and I said that I'd like your advice as to whether or not this is typical, because if it is, I'm going to resign and do something else. And he said, "But I can almost guarantee you that this is a one in a million occurrence, and you won't find that kind of prejudice the rest of your career in the Navy." And that turned out to be the case. It was also the case that there was some additional hazard in that the rules for clearances above the level of top secret have always required that you declare any relatives behind the Iron Curtain. And Musa's mother and aunt were two of about 11 children, the only two that escaped. Others, some of the brothers were shot, and everybody else who was left behind in Russia. So we knew that there were aunts and uncles, and undoubtedly that there were nephews and nieces and cousins, but we didn't know the names. There had been no communication. Both the mother and the aunt had been afraid to have any communication after communism was established, because they were afraid that it would lead their siblings to being sent off to gulag. So I had to report that there were undoubtedly relatives behind the Iron Curtain, but we couldn't state who they were. And when I was working for Paul Nitze as a captain in the Navy, and he was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, he was told that he was going to be the Deputy Secretary of Defense. As it turned out, he didn't get it at that time and became Secretary of the Navy instead. But he instructed me to get the clearances above top secret, which I would need to go with him and be his exec in that job. And the Army colonel, who saw my forms and saw that I had declared that we had relatives unknown by name behind the Iron Curtain, made the arbitrary decision, "We can't clear you." And Paul Nitze overruled it and said, "Clear him." So that was a policy level decision, and it was never questioned again. But it followed me even to that extent, you know, and could have, in other circumstances, have been a real career stopper. Mm. As it turned out, everything worked out well.
Well, speaking of your career, I understand you had not necessarily a positive view of continued military service at war's end, simply because you didn't want to subject your wife to, you know, she's a foreigner, she's trying to adjust to life in the United States. You don't want to necessarily continue in the Navy, be at sea, and leave her behind. And it was a meeting with George Marshall, at least, that helped you change your mind.
Right.
And I find that very interesting. I mean, what was your, or describe the circumstances that surrounded the meeting and how did this affect you?
At that time I was the professor, the assistant professor at NROTC, and we were living in a little village called Victor Village, which were university homes. It cost us $33 a month to live in these little two-bedroom clapboard homes. And the next-door neighbor was a Dr. Jim Caldwell, a history professor, whose wife, Caroline, had an aunt that came to visit them. And her lifelong friend was Mrs. Marshall, the wife who had married George Marshall. She'd been a widow, and George Marshall was unmarried until he was, I think, a colonel, and then they had married. And they, by that time, General Marshall had finished his tenure as Secretary of State. He was not yet Secretary of Defense, and he was living down in Pinehurst, which was just a 60 or 65 mile ride from Chapel Hill. And Mrs. Walker, this aunt, wanted to go down and visit Mrs. Marshall. I jumped at the chance to drive her down so I could meet the general. And Musa came with me, and our older, we had two children then, and Elmo was, I guess, 2 years old, maybe three. And so the three of us went with Mrs. Walker, the aunt, and with Mrs. Caldwell and her daughter. And we were invited to come down there for lunch. We had lunch, and then the wives all talked, and the general and I had a couple of hours in which I was just pumping him like mad. He was just a great man. You felt like you were talking to a saint, you know, when you talked to him. And I asked him all kinds of questions about the war. Among other things, I had said how debilitated we were at that time. I had just come from that execs tour on the destroyer, and we couldn't get spare parts for our engineering equipment or for our radars. Louis Johnson, the Secretary of Defense, had cut defense budgets so badly that we didn't have enough personnel to run the engine rooms. We'd have to steam for 8 hours and then stop while our engineers got some sleep or anchor. And I was complaining that we were in just terrible shape. And he said, you know, young man, you shouldn't worry. And he described how prior to World War I we'd been in the same shape, and prior to World War II we'd been in the same shape. And he said, this country is a sleeping giant. And when it gets awakened, it can recover very rapidly. But he said, we are headed for another war. And you withdraw that resignation, because we're going to be in that war in another year or two.
Had you already put in a resignation? Or?
Yeah, I had been accepted for this. We were right at the same time when Musa had been insulted by this action of the Georgia wife. I had been accepted for medical school by the University of California.
Which had always been your...
My long-term objective,
anyway.
Right, and I had pretty much decided that that's what I was going to do. I was highly motivated in that direction because of my dad, and this discouraging action in the Chapel Hill from the Georgia wife. And when I got through that fascinating day, and when he said that to me, I just figured, my golly, I'd stick around. That's the impression, that's the impact that he had on me. Mm-hmm. And to show you, you know, what his computer like mind was like, when we got ready to leave, he said, Lieutenant, how long did it take you to get here? And I said, an hour. He said, it's 65 miles to Chapel Hill. You must have driven 70 to get here. Slow down going home. Aye, aye, sir.
I find it very interesting that you have had a lifelong desire to be the doctor, that you are uncertain that you want to stay in the Navy, and that just a relatively short discussion with the one man completely turns.
Yeah, but you see, I had read about him for the previous 7 or 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
I, I had followed his strategy all through the war. I knew his tremendous impact. He really was the strategic genius that Roosevelt used. And so I was already, to me, he was already a legend when I was meeting with him. So it wasn't that he just charmed me overnight, you know.
Sure. Dean Acheson, I suppose Marshall was very well regarded by everyone. Dean Acheson said that he was the most impressive public servant that he ever saw in a career of public service.
Right. Paul Mitzer feels the same way about him. And said that he was a terrific man to work for. Paul did his NSC 68 while working for Marshall, and also Paul wrote the original draft of the Marshall Plan for General Marshall. I'm going to need to go get rid of some coffee.
Sure. What are your impressions of serving in the Navy in the early Cold War period? That when we realize now that the Soviet Union is the threat, what was your experience in the Navy at that time, considering that the Soviet Navy wasn't really a threat at the time? What was the focus of what you did and your experience?
Well, I had felt all through World War II that our next enemy was going to be the Soviet Union, even though we were allies in World War II, knowing the brutal history of what Stalin had done in overrunning one country after another and in liquidating his own intelligentsia. So I had gotten a Russian book and had started studying Russian toward the end of World War II, and that was why when I met Musa, as the best way to start pursuing her, I asked her if she would start to teach me Russian. I already knew some limited Russian. So I think I was among those who very early on felt that we had to prepare for a whole new phase. The theory immediately after the war that the United States wise men started out with is they were going to try to make the thing work with Russia, that Britain would be the forward line of defense east of Suez, as they had been before the war, and that the United States, Russia, and Britain would, working together in the United Nations, kind of keep the world stable and peaceful. It became clear very soon after the war that Stalin was not going to make that possible. He began to overrun one country after another in Europe by threats or actual occupation. When Winston Churchill in 1948 gave his Fulton, Missouri speech stating that an Iron Curtain had fallen across Europe, that sort of formalized the fact that we had to have a whole new strategy. About that time, George Kennan articulated the containment philosophy, which very rapidly became U.S. policy, and I, throughout my career, strongly believed that the containment policy was necessary, and during those periods when we had administrations that tended to back away from it or not enforce it very credibly, I worried a lot, and when we had administrations that were stronger, I felt very comfortable. Therefore, I was, I would say, a very vigorous advocate in every one of my jobs for making the containment policy work. It was for that reason that when I was a captain in the Navy working for Paul Nitzer in ISA, I worked hard to get Diego Garcia, this ideal piece of real estate in the middle of the Indian Ocean, about 1,200 miles south of the tip of India, freed from the rest of the archipelago so that we could make a major base there, and I had the thrill of getting it done when I was a Navy chief. And that base, we probably couldn't have saved Israel without having it, and with great significance to us in the Desert Storm conflict. And I strongly advocated the creation of a string of bases around the Soviet Union. And as I described in that meeting with General Marshall, even in 1948 or 1949, was deeply worried about the fact that we had let our military guard down, to which he agreed, and that's why he felt we were headed for another war, that Stalin was going to do something that would force us in, as he did when he persuaded the North Koreans to invade South Korea.
So all of these major issues, containment, Soviet expansion, and the danger of all of that, was that readily apparent to you even then?
Yes,
as
it was.
A young officer?
It was. I think in that regard, I was different than many, in that I had done a lot of reading about, you know, geopolitics, and I had read Haushofer and Mackinder, and understood, maybe ahead of my time, that we had a lifelong, career-long challenge.
Mm-hmm. Other than those broad issues, like, for example, containment, what were the major issues for young officers in the immediate post-war period in the Navy? I mean, what was the focus of the development of your career at that point?
Up until I had gone ashore in 1948, it was one of just staying alive, keeping the ship able to have a semblance of readiness. Mm-hmm. As I said, we were so poorly staffed with the personnel, all of the experience was permitted to leave. At the end of the war, if you had a certain number of points, you could get out, whether the ship needed you or not. So what happened was you had a few chief petty officers with 15 to 18 years experience that were staying.